Well, that was interesting, wasn't it, Dara? Always nice to hear what's going on up in Scotland. And I think what they're planning for the River Dee is brave and progressive. And if done correctly, could be a real example of what the future might hold for these Scottish rivers.
Yeah, it's the action. It's the proactive measures that have been taken. I think that's what's heartening for anglers. You know, when we spoke to Robert Mitchell, the Spey Gilly, as part of that episode, you know, you could hear the despondency. You know, he said how they're fearful for the day that is, you know, will there be no salmon left? But then you have Colin saying, well, there's targeted measures that we're trying to do. And Colin, of course, was positive. He was the glass half full man when it came to the future of the salmon.
I think so. I think my takeaway from that, what was really heartening, I think, was Colin saying he doesn't believe the salmon is going to go extinct. He doesn't believe we're going to lose it, at least in our lifetime, if ever, because he believes that that fish is so resilient, so such an evolutionary marvel of a species that it will outwit the challenges that it faces and live to fight another day. And that to me was incredibly heartening. I think maybe as an angler, I'm a little despondent as to the numbers we might be looking at. But as a lover of the king of fish, it was an incredibly enthusiastic episode, I think, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly. Now, maybe for anglers this season, we mightn't see the turnaround on the bank. But you know, this is long-term stuff. So again, look, let's keep the heart and keep the faith for that. Speaking of actions and being proactive, this week's guest is one person who really has shown what can be done. We're going to go from the freshwater to the oceans. And he has shown in terms of influence, money, talking to governments, talking to politicians, what kind of change you can impact.
He gets things done, doesn't he? There's no messing with Charles Clover. He's a well-connected, well-backed, incredibly erudite, educated, learned, passionate activist, I think, but he's so much more than that. He heads up the Blue Marine Foundation, now one of the leading lights in marine conservation. He's also an author, isn't he, Dara?
He is. He wrote Rewilding the Sea, amongst others, How to Save Our Oceans, a book we'd highly recommend. He just talks about the kind of stuff that the Blue Marine Foundation has done, whether it's around the waters around the UK, whether it's waters in the Southern Atlantic, just what they've done in terms of protecting certain areas, how they've gone about doing it. And I think, again, for people who read this, again, it fills you with hope. You read this and go, it's worked here. It can work in other places too.
Exactly. And more recently, they've been in the news because they are taking the UK government to court. They're suing them for enabling overfishing. I know that's a case he's been working on personally for quite some time. And if they win that case, it will be revolutionary when it comes to the overfishing and the super trawlers out in our waters. So watch this space. But of course, it all started, didn't it, Dara, with Charles stood in a salmon river in the 80s and learning that this fish isn't coming back in the numbers that it should. So let's jump in and hear what Charles Clover has to say.
I mean, I got into marine conservation because I was a salmon fisherman. I wanted to know why the salmon were returning in fewer and fewer numbers. And that was from the 80s onwards. I caught a very large salmon, and the very large salmon didn't keep coming. And I researched how those large salmon had failed in the early 1900s and been reseeded in that salmon river rather successfully, and how these huge Norwegian strains of salmon came back to the Welsh Dee. It was cyclical, and they were very big, and some of them were in the 40 odd pound salmon. And then the 60s came, and the salmon disease and the netting and so on. And so there were cyclical problems. We've had these problems before. And the salmon has gone on coming back, but it is now in a greater decline than we've seen for a long time. I don't honestly know enough about the salmon's biology, because I've been concentrating on other marine biology for so long. I don't know. I don't have particular theories that you won't hear from anybody else. But what needs to be done is to break down all the various component parts of what this migratory fish, of the life cycle of this migratory fish, and something seems to be attacking all of them at the moment. Whether it's sewage in the southern English rivers or temperature in the temperature booms or blobs, as they're called in the Pacific, in the North Atlantic. So it's challenged by temperature, by pollution, and by fishing activity, which is the most important. I couldn't tell you, but all of these things will need looking at if we are going to save the salmon.
It's recently been, I guess, certified by the scientists that the Vorring Plateau, do you know, off Sweden, up there in the sort of North Sea, Norwegian Sea, North Norwegian Sea, is where a great majority of the salmon go to feed, because there's a huge upwelling there, multi-species fish. But it's because of that, it's littered with industrial trawlers. Now, it's very difficult to prove that they're catching the fish as bycatch, but we have reason to believe that they are. And obviously, if you the numbers being as they are for the salmon, if you catch, I don't know, even 100 mature fish, you could be wiping out a huge swathe or even a whole generation of a river's returning spawning fish. With the experience you've had with industrial trawlers, what might you offer to NGOs or campaigners or activists alike in order to bring attention and properly prove this theory?
The availability of forage fish is very important in the salmon's life cycle. The availability of krill over in towards Greenland, where they go. I'm sorry, I can't distinguish between temperature and fisheries here. I think that temperature is undoubtedly a problem, that certain birds and forage fish do not thrive in warm temperatures, and that's something that's going on in the Pacific and in the Atlantic. And there will be less fish. There will be less food for the salmon at certain times because of that temperature. I think you have to assume that's the case. Nobody seems to really prove that industrial activity for either forage fish or pelagic trawling activity has really having a significant impact upon smolt migration, which is what I think certain people have set out to find, the Atlantic Salmon Trust and others, with all fishing activity and spawning activity. It's generally a good idea not to have fishing on it during the foraging or breeding seasons. And so there are no, as far as I know, marine protected areas for salmon alone. And actually, funny enough, the Russians were thinking of having one a few years ago, never did. And you know, that is one of the tools that we have found very useful in the world for improving the productivity of lots of fish. You know, if you can identify somewhere where the salmon are for a lot of the time and prevent people fishing for them or fishing for their forage species, I mean, that is a thing that's not been done. I don't know whether it would work in the salmon's life cycle, but it's a thing that we do in every other aspect of things. And then there is fisheries management, and that's in the sea. I mean, obviously the biggest problem the salmon seems to be facing is in the sea, but you know, I do wonder from the first time I actually got interested in this as a subject back in the 80s, when David Solomon wrote a paper saying that the problem of the Welsh, the Herefordshire Wye, that which used to have produced these enormous sort of 40-pound salmon, the extermination of the salmon in the Wye was really largely down to people with rod and line. Now, you do have to wonder whether us fishing less because there are fewer salmon might actually be a good thing. I'm afraid. Maybe we were fishing too much. I mean, we have to look at all, we have to look, you know, completely honestly at all forms of exploitation of the salmon. and whether or not we're taking too many or as the world is these days, returning them with catch and release, but are we doing it properly? You know, what are the reasons for salmon mortality that we can affect? I mean, there seems to be an awful lot that we can't.
If we were to broaden it out, Charles, and maybe just to paint a picture for people about the oceans in terms of the overfishing, in terms of the subsidies that don't work, in terms of the long-distance trawler fleets that are, you know, dredging the oceans. You might just give us an overview and just kind of paint that picture in terms of the collapse of fish stocks, the effects this has had, and, you know, like I said, the EU fleet, the Chinese fleet, how these are just essentially hoovering up just massive numbers of fish all over the world.
Well, the global picture, as the UN Food and Agriculture Organization rather euphemistically puts it every year, or every couple of years, I mean, it's a state of world fisheries, is that over 90% of marine fish are either fully or overexploited. So overfishing is a major problem in the world. There are countries that are not always the countries you think either that manage their fisheries relatively well. The United States, with the exclusion of the exemption of the probably the East Coast, where it hasn't done very well, has a very good law. It does within its own waters pretty good job. I don't think the EU does, and the EU doesn't do a very good job in distant water circumstances either, because it has a distant water fleet that catches tuna principally, that behaves quite badly at times and does overfish other people's oceans, and where it has no footprint on the coastal area. So you do wonder whether this is just a completely colonial exercise. But the greatest colonial fleet in the world today is Chinese, and it's somewhere over 15,000 vessels. And the Chinese Belt and Road imperialist exercise has received far too little attention. And some of these Chinese vessels are now sort of buying their way into other countries. So they become even harder to spot and harder to do anything about. That's assuming that they're behaving badly, which they don't always do. But there is a basic exploitative thrust by China, which feels very strongly that it needs to feed its billions, and quite understandably, but it is doing various reprehensible things in terms of salmon, where it is catching forage fish off the coast of Africa, the sardinellas and so on, and putting them through fishmeal plants, whereas they were previously low priced fish that were being sold by and to the local population. So the collapse of those West African fisheries is another reason why you see inflatable boats trying to cross the Mediterranean with migrants, or indeed the English Channel. I mean, some of these people are from Senegal, where they have nothing left. And these imperialistic fleets, frankly, should be stopped. And it is a noble quest to try and make that happen. But realistically, we have to deal with the Chinese, and we have to deal with the international fisheries regime. The levers that we possibly have, which are still slightly intangible because they're not yet fully agreed to after a very long time, are the subsidies regime, which the World Trade Organization has tried to do something about. And for the first agreement it seems to have actually made in 22 years is an agreement to reduce fisheries subsidies. How that affects China and how it affects the EU, which doesn't think it applies to its fleets, I don't know. Everybody who signed up to that in 2022, every country that still has to agree it in a formal way, that hasn't happened yet, and that the language needs to be improved. It doesn't appear to apply to fuel subsidies. Now, if you look around the world at fuel subsidies, there's a lot of it going on. The Chinese are up to it, but you know, if you look at what Britain is doing, it's quite extraordinary. I don't think anybody has actually publicized this yet, but an expert group looked at the fisheries subsidies that the UK gives its own fishing fleets, and they are quite extraordinary. And they are far greater than the government thought they were at the time of these World Trade Organization negotiations, in which Britain, like America and other people, has this very virtuous line that we shouldn't subsidize fisheries. Well, if you look at what Britain does, I mean, we are giving something called fuel tax concessions. Now, you know, fishermen get cheap fuel, get the fuel with the tax knocked off. Bunker fuel, red diesel with the tax knocked off, like fish, like farmers do, but they pay even less than farmers. Farmers pay 11p tax. Fishermen pay nothing, and the distortion that this causes in our fisheries towards the more industrial forms of exploitation is quite dramatic, because you wouldn't be able to run a scallop dredger or a beam trawler or a nephrops trawler in the North Sea. And all of these operations are technically, you know, destructive. They are destroying seabed.
Literally habitat. Like plowing up the seabed like a farmer would plow a field.
It's like harrowing a field. Yeah, exactly. And so we are subsidizing people to harrow our seabed. This is crazy. And these activities, I am told, would be bankrupt, would not be viable if we weren't giving these subsidies. And the subsidies, these tax concessions, these tax breaks amount to somewhere between 150 and 180 million a year. That's about a fifth of the, just under a fifth of the total turnover of the fishing industry. That's crazy. We are subsidizing by a fifth of the actual value we're getting back our various activities that we don't need to exist at all and which are destructive. Where's the public good in that?
Is that an overhang, Charles? Is that a sort of archaic overhang from a regulation that was implemented decades ago?
I think it's just been a natural assumption since the war that the fishermen were doing a good thing. Mm. They were providing food. And like farmers, they needed to be able to do it as cheaply as possible, because we needed, you know, after the collapse of the economies of Europe in 1945, we wanted cheap food. And nobody's re-examined it ever since. I mean, we've re-examined dig for victory, but we haven't re-examined cheap fish. And fish evidently isn't cheap. Mm. It evidently isn't feeding the urban poor, at least not the fish we catch. We've overfished the fish we catch. We import fish from Iceland and Norway and occasionally Russia pre-Ukraine war, which we actually feed ourselves in our fish and chip shops, whereas we export most of what we catch in the way of langoustines and scallops and so on, for a lot of money to other countries who pay even more for it than we do. So there isn't a food security argument anymore for this subsidy.
So we need to re-examine that, as you quite rightly pointed out. How would, Dara and I were discussing before we jumped onto this conversation, that there is an increasing call for citizen scientists, for activism, for people to get proactive as apathy becomes increasingly the enemy and corruption and all the rest of it is coming to the fore, and politics in general. How do we go about actually forcing this change through, which is so obviously needed?
Support the right organizations, I think, because nobody can do this on their own. We set up an organization 13 years ago on the back of a film that we made, which is quite successful, called The End of the Line.
Great film.
And everybody said, well, why don't you set up an organization? Because the ones in this field aren't doing enough. Well, whether or not that was true, whether there's people's perception was right, though it was a fairly uncrowded field at the time. And so we set up the Blue Marine Foundation. We tried to do things. And after 13 years, we now have the capacity and the fundraising ability to actually do some of them. At the beginning, we didn't. So organizations, non-governmental organizations, need cherishing, they need funding, and they need supporters. And we can't all do this ourselves. So that's one thing that needs to be done is have a very flourishing third sector, which is not the government, which is holding the government to account, which is saying, well, don't you think there are some solutions here which we could all work on together? That's what third sector is meant to do. And we're doing it. So we will suggest strongly that the subsidies, for example, are really not the way we should be going in the world of the Paris Agreement and climate change and the biodiversity crisis. These are subsidies that are militating against that. Everybody else is having to do something about their fuel use. Why shouldn't the fishing industry? But there's an even more fundamental and interesting thing that we can do about it going on right now, which is that after this curious thing called Brexit, Britain is actually making its own laws in a rather sort of timid way for the first time in 50 years or even longer in fisheries terms. And it's not at all clear that the laws either are right or that they are delivering the outcomes they're meant to deliver or that they're looking after our national resources, our national natural resources, in a responsible way that you would have to do with oil and gas or with any other commodity that the public owns. So we are particularly annoyed that the government continues to allocate fishing opportunities above scientific advice. Something like 65% of all fishing opportunities last year were allocated above scientific advice. In 2023, it was 57%, nearly 60% above scientific advice. This is crazy. That is overfishing. That's institutionalized overfishing. Now, I don't think that's even legal according to our own new Fisheries Act, which has been carefully written so that nobody can judicially review the government or hold ministers to account, because that's what civil servants like to do, to keep their ministers safe. But we don't even think that it is safe, that they are safe, and we don't think that that is a justifiable thing to do with fish, which are, or the right to fish, is actually the property of the Crown on behalf of the people of Britain. Who the right to fish is owned by in the European Union? I'm glad you asked me that question. It was so confused that no owner was able to complain. But people, notably in Ireland, have got their heads around this one and complained to the European Commission that overfishing is happening. The Friends of the Irish Environment and Client Earth have a case which has got as far as the European Court, and has got as far as an Advocate General ruling that says that the Council of Ministers have no discretion, none at all, to allocate fishing opportunities above scientific advice, because their 2013 reforms of the Common Fisheries Policy say explicitly they must not. But that's what they've been doing. So that court case is a jolly interesting one going on in Brussels. And we, Blue, decided that we should have an equal and opposite case in the very different law that now pertains in the UK to see whether we could at least identify the responsibilities of ministers in this regard as to whether or not they should be looking to get the maximum public benefit from their natural resources, or whether they were allowed, because of the special pleading by the fishing industry, in of a very short-term nature, to go on allocating fishing opportunities that ran the stocks down. I mean, we have, for example, this year, we have a couple more. I mean, it's depressing to say this. We have a couple more zero tax total allowable catches. The way that these things are set out by scientists, by ICES, the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea, which regulates, which advises scientifically the European Commission and the UK government and Norway in the Northeast Atlantic. The way that these recommendations are set out is in the form of the recommended total allowable catch. Well, we've got a couple of zeros, a couple of new zeros in the UK waters. One is the Channel and Celtic Sea pollock. I think another one is the either plaice or the sole in the Celtic Sea. Celtic Sea is very hammered. We've got this crisis at the moment. The Mevaga Sea trawlermen and netsmen in Cornwall quite rightly saying, "Oi, you know, you're going to put us out of business if you stop us catching pollock." But if you look at the figures, we've been allocating catches to them, allowing them to catch more than scientific advice since the 80s. This is a very long, you know, slow motion accident. They could have complained a lot earlier that they were being allowed to catch too much, but they're now complaining they're not going to be allowed to catch anything at all. And I have some sympathy, but not that much sympathy, because they were complicit in this. And they only complain when they're not allowed to catch what they want to catch. They don't complain when they're being allowed to catch too much.
But you went from just writing about problems to actually doing something about it in terms of setting up the Blue Marine Foundation. Was it just, I just want to take it back a little bit, was it to that period for you yourself? Was it that just writing about it wasn't enough anymore? You were so passionate about the issues that you were seeing, you didn't think they were being dealt with in the right way. Was that such a strong draw for you that you felt impelled that you had to go set this up and kind of move on from journalism?
Well, I'm still a journalist, really. I just use it in a different way. And my, you know, my campaigns are projects and my projects are campaigns. But I suppose I was a specialist journalist. I was an environment editor for a long time. And so my focus just narrowed. I wrote this book, was quite successful. And I wrote this, the script of this film, it's quite successful, which led on. And people said, well, would you like to solve the problems that you've been writing about all this time? It wasn't that I thought I would. I didn't know there was even a remote possibility that I could. But if you put one foot in front of the other and go in the direction that people seem to want you to go in, and that you'll be very happy to go in yourself. Slowly, we have built this structure, and we have gone from being a small charity to a medium-sized charity with all sorts of head-aching reporting requirements and HR policies and God knows what that you have these days, just because we just put one foot in front of the other, and we did actually seem to be succeeding. And bouncing governments into doing good things that they wouldn't otherwise have done.
How is it? Because when you read the book, Rewilding the Sea, where you talk about the access to the corridors of power in terms of getting ministers to sign on for what you were trying to do in terms of the marine reserves, you were able to knock on the doors and you were able to open those doors, or at least have sympathetic ears to listen to what you were saying. What was the secret to that?
Well, I knew all these people, I suppose. I mean, it wasn't just me, but you are people who know the people, and you know the people. So It does help to be from the business of journalism, because you're sort of in the middle between the conservationists and the fishing industry and so on. So, you know, for a while, until you become a strident environmentalist and attacking the industry, they will listen to you, whereas they wouldn't listen to other people. And you have a certain sort of track record that they'll listen to as well, of looking on the one hand and on the other with the industry. And then with the politicians, you know, if you're a prominent journalist, you know them and they know you. And so that position, I suppose, that was a position where Blue Marine Foundation did have a little bit of the edge compared to other marine charities, perhaps, because we were right in the thick of it. We were, you know, we were based in the center of London, a 5-minute walk from Parliament and a 5-minute walk from the law courts and, you know, a 10-minute walk from the city. So those that sort of access was very important to us, rather more so than the, you know, the usual sort of academic marine biologists who formally set up charities, because that's not their world. So we needed the marine biologists, but that was our world. And so that's why we had access, because people, we knew them.
Would you consider yourself now, or would you be considered a strident environmentalist, or do you still have the ear of those in power as much?
Well, I think you, as ever, the best you can do at any time is have the ear of some of the people in power. You have to argue with their colleagues. So there are one or two people in power who in this government or any future government who we would know, and we would try and say, well, you know, these are the options available to you. Which you want to do? Which do you think you can get away with? Which do you think you might be able to achieve in your term of office, or is it just too difficult? I think our job is, unlike, and I have to constantly tell myself this, is not, you know, saying, you know, this is all wrong and the following people are to blame, which is what I did as a journalist. In this world, as I'm constantly being reminded, you know, the job is to package up the problem, say that the solutions do exist, and these ones are politically achievable now, and why don't you take the credit for doing them? that's the job. And so, you know, banging people over the knuckles and shouting and screaming is not really something that I find very productive to do. Yet people have to be told that certain things, it's a subsidy regime, are completely wrong, and it's time. But you know, historically, you know, who's to blame? But let's try and edge our way around this and do it better next time.
So in essence, you're doing their job for them. You know, instead of just reprimanding them and holding them to account as politicians, ministers, as regulators of our country, you also have to offer them the solutions that they should be looking at themselves, it sounds.
That they can take credit for.
That they can then take credit for, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Fred, that's what you have to do. I mean, whether it's proposing that Britain should actually put marine protected areas around all its overseas territories, which I was responsible for doing at one point, and now very successfully is the largest network of marine protected areas on Earth, the Blue Belt. We did suggest to the government that it could do that, that it wouldn't cost it very much, and it will get enormous amount of credit by doing that. And David Cameron's government, as it happens, ironically, decided that yes, he would do that. And that was an example of offering them a solution. They probably, in power, didn't have the time to be ambitious enough to conceive for themselves, which was entirely doable, and has brought about a great result. But you know, there are other examples of us trying to do that. It's about a lot of it's about setting the ambition for politicians, which they don't really have time to. If they didn't go into government with that ambition, it's they're then pummeled and punched by events, as Harold Macmillan would have called it. And events are a terrible sort of traumatizer. They can't think, they can't do anything. They have to just do the immediate day-to-day. And so somebody wandering in saying, well, here's an ambition that you might want to have. I don't know whether you do or not, but it is possible to achieve this now very necessary thing, and here's how you do it, and here's what it costs, and here's how much opposition you'll get for it, and you make the decision. So that's how I try to package everything up these days.
That's great advice. Isn't that fantastic advice? And everything, something we knew, but to hear it firsthand like that is invaluable.
Yeah, and I think, Charles, obviously with your work as the journalist, you know, you were at the corridors of power. You saw how they worked. You knew what buttons to press, I suppose, and that kind of helped then in terms of your subsequent work with the Blue Marine Foundation. Just tell us, you mentioned the Blue Belt there, Charles. What's some of the examples that you're most proud of in terms of the successes with the Blue Marine Foundation?
Well, it probably has to start with these huge MPAs around British Overseas Territories, because that's where we got in. We came, we started with the Chagos, which was and obviously a very vexed territory. The Britain had ejected expelled its population. Nobody really wanted to touch it, but there was a huge opportunity to not only protect its waters, but to create a precedent that rolled out across other people's far off islands, and that was actually what was uttermost in my mind when we did it. But the whole 15 years of campaigning by other charities had led to the pass where a marine protected area was proposed in the Chagos, but as the election loomed in 2010, the Labour government was pretty much skint and had no money to do it. So our only contribution to that particular solution was to spot that this was a huge ask. This, if you in terms of a selling point, you know, would you like your name on the biggest marine reserve ever created, was a very attractive bauble for a very rich man or woman. And we thought we could find one in the time available, and we did. So having done that one, it then took 5 years and by the way, the Chagos, the British government has now decided it isn't giving the Chagos to Mauritius, I gather. Things are moving pretty fast in that direction as well. And then, you see, having created the principle that there should be marine protection around these, what used to be called fragments of paradise, these extraordinary places which were part of the British Empire, but then given some self-determination, but could not actually become independent territories because they were in most cases too small, though in Bermuda's case it's still arguable. These fragments of paradise should be protected. There were no obvious fleets in most cases, except Falkland, where they just make a lot of money out of licensing foreign fleets. But in most of these cases, there was no indigenous fishing industry, and there was no reason to fish them. And there was a good reason to protect the environment for tourism and for the future, and so that case, when it was properly made, was persuasive. And 5 years later, we managed to get a Cameron government to protect, in the first instance, thanks to American prompting, the Pitcairn Islands, and then Ascension, and then to package the whole thing up and call it the Blue Belt. And that only applies to those self-determining countries that and islands, territories is what I'm trying to say, the self-determining territories who want to be part of it, because with it comes funding for marine conservation objectives. But more and more, including the Caribbean now, are joining up. So it's quite a sort of big thing in the world, the blue belt.
Well, I was going to say, Charles,
Lion Bay.
Yeah, Lion Bay, because the interesting thing, actually, Jim, between, say, Lion Bay and, say, Ascension and all these places, it's the buy-in of the local people, isn't it?
Yeah. Marine conservation tends to be a sort of bottom-up and a top-down thing. If there's too much top-down, the locals don't like it and revolt against it, and that's happened a couple of times in Scotland, once quite recently over highly protected marine areas where everybody got the wrong idea and they said it was the same as the Highland clearances and other such utter nonsense. And conservation was set back maybe 25 years. But so you don't want to upset the locals. But we perceived that there was a danger there when quite splendidly and in an entirely enlightened way, the last Labour government in the UK banned trawling in this area of great biodiversity in Lion Bay, where the scallop dredges is a dredging and trawling. The dredges were basically harrying the corals and sea fans of Lion Bay, which deserved a life, and the local fishermen supported the local inshore fishermen, static potting and netting fishermen. Supported a ban on trawling and dredging, and having supported it, the government declared a ban and then just sort of walked away. There was no benefit for those fishermen, and the recovery took a long time there to happen. It did happen in the end, and now we've got four times the amount of species, four times the amount of commercially harvestable fish because of the benefits of not trawling or dredging. So it's come good, and what's come even more good is that we've literally come to the end of our project, and we've handed it back to the fishermen. They have set up a community interest company, which has many of the objectives that we all agreed on over the course of that 11 years or something, to promote conservation. So here we have a community interest company promoting conservation run by fishermen. Result. So. That's how I'd like to do it. I'd like to see that proliferated everywhere. There are lots of community interest companies. Some of them work, some of them don't. The more the local people, the more fishermen you have on the board, the better they work.
We were just talking, weren't we, Dara, is the artisanal angle, which you talk about in your book so well. If we can reintroduce a more artisanal way of fishing, local communities looking after themselves, run by themselves, then that's a really positive and progressive move.
We're dealing with wild animals here. We're not dealing with industrial production. Wild animals need to have that space to reproduce and breed and migrate and so on. That industrial fishing methods just don't allow them to have. And industrial methods are driving down fish populations everywhere. The future is artisanal.
Can I, though, challenge you on that, Charles? How realistic is that? You know, we mentioned the Chinese earlier. We mentioned the EU long-distance fleets. You know, the demand is soaring in terms of the growing global population. We know what governments and politicians are like. We know what it's like. You know, we've covered aquaculture, fish farming on this podcast series in terms of the multi-billion dollar industry that it is. How realistic is it to expect or to hope that we can return to artisanal fishing?
Well, it's obviously going to be a different kind of artisanal fishing. It's going to have to be much safer. It's going to be technologically much more advanced. But there's no reason why we shouldn't catch the fish that we're currently catching by much more artisanal, high-tech artisanal means. And there is, there are some bads, some public bads that we need to grind out of the system, notably, very heavy machinery dredging up the seabed, which also damages our ability to damage the ocean's ability to soak up carbon. Now that's going to have to stop. The amount of fuel they're being subsidized to use and the amount of seabed they're damaging means that what they're doing is no longer perceptible as a public good. If you first do no harm, And you'll find that, yes, we are fishing in what you could call a more artisanal way.
What I found fascinating in your book, Rewilding the Sea, was while I might be skeptical in terms of our ability or the politicians' ability to downgrade, you know, industrial fishing, is the actual benefits that you see in terms of carbon capture that you mentioned. Like, there's the IMF report on the value of the whales, that if you increase, if you increase the population of the whales to, was it 4.5-5 million from 1.3 million as it currently stands, you're capturing the CO2 equivalent of Russia's annual CO2 emissions. We nearly need to reframe people's minds in the sense of, by preserving this, we're actually, for the future, we're actually taking out the damage.
Kelp forests as well, you know, let's slap preservations on those and let's encourage those to come on. That was a real eye opener for us, Charles, the carbon offset that can be implemented that goes hand in hand with industrial fishing or artisanal fishing or whatever, or our seas in general, that is really something that sounds like we're at the beginning of and could be a really, really powerful argument going forward.
I think it will be, but we need the numbers, because just because something's a good thing, it seems to be incredibly difficult to get people to do it, whereas they need numbers. So with the particular difficulty is in the case of the kelp, that the kelp clearly soaks up carbon, clearly quite a lot of it, but the kelp is essentially a deciduous forest. It's an algae which declines seasonally, like a deciduous forest. So where do the leaves go? Well, where does that go? Well, some of it floats away into the sea. Some of it lands up on the beach. Farmers used to put it in the soil as fertilizer. Does that happen anymore? Don't know. It's just with kelp, it's extraordinarily difficult to know where the carbon goes. With other things, it's much easier. With the actual sediment that is churned up by trawling and dredging, it's much easier to say where it's going, whether it's in the water column, whether the water column releases it into the atmosphere, how animals in the sediment pull down the latest parcels of carbon and turn them and bind them into the seabed. And that's a really fascinating process that almost nobody has really looked at until now. And it's obviously out there in the continental shelves of the world is doing a huge amount to stabilize the climate every day, and yet we don't know the numbers. So we got a very large insurance company called Convex to pay for a very large research program about carbon, seabed carbon, which is called the Convex Seabed Survey, and is basically the largest project we've ever done. And they are looking at that now. And they found all sorts of animals that are particularly good and some that aren't very good in the sediments for actually pulling down carbon. And this whole process, the sea, the ocean's ability to pull down carbon and the nature-based solutions that we might resort to, which are a lot easier than many of the other things we're trying to do. And in fact, we don't really know how we're going to achieve net zero very easily, but the sea has been left out. So we need to understand these things. We need to favor these nature-based solutions if we are going to stabilize our climate.
We're only scratching the surface, really, aren't we, in terms of what the ocean can actually do to help?
Just starting. I mean, remember, you know, 30 years ago when I was a reporter putting climate change stories on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Indeed, I put the first big ones in the 80s when Mrs. Thatcher made a speech to the Royal Society saying we'd undertaken a gigantic experiment with the climate, with the planet itself. And I got that on the front page, no other paper splashed on it. When all that happened, I said, well, what about the sea? Oh, the sea is our biggest carbon sink. Well, how does it do it? And for about 20 years, I thought it was in some way sort of chemical. But actually, the sea is animate, apart from, obviously, phytoplankton, the plants of the vast areas of the sea grow phytoplankton. But everything else is an animal that eats phytoplankton, that something then eats it, and it then drops to the bottom or forms some calciform structure of skeleton and drops down or is eaten by something else, which we take out of the sea. So, you know, there's a huge process there that people haven't properly looked at. And I like this one figure, which came from a Yale paper, which is that fish, like whales, absorb carbon and indeed are carbon. And they're more efficient than whales because there are more of them than whales. And they absorb twice the carbon emissions of the EU27 every year. And yet we don't manage them for profusion. We take a hell of a lot of them out of the sea very wastefully. We burn some of them to make salmon feed and or cook them up. And you know, this whole process is not done in the foreknowledge that healthy fish populations are stabilizing the planet, which they are.
It's highly, highly unsustainable, isn't it? The whole, every aspect of it seems to me, having read your book, having listened to you just now, we are primitive in the way we catch our fish, process our fish, decide and regulate which fish and how much and how many we catch. It really is we're in a massive need for a huge overhaul. Just going back to the salmon, we ask our guest, Charles, a couple of questions. It may sound pretty rudimentary. If you had $1 billion, euros, pounds, whatever, an insurmountable amount of money, what would you do with it to help mitigate the drastic demise of the Atlantic salmon?
I hope enough is being spent on science and the warming of the North Atlantic and warming of the North Pacific both seem to be producing results which show massively declining salmon populations in both areas. So because it's happening in two oceans, I think somebody ought to be spending some money on it. I'm not sure we're spending enough. And then I would look at some of the extractive activities, whether other industries are compromising the salmon's ability to survive. I would be much more likely to spend that money on law, because I don't think there's ever been a proper litigation from a wild system against a salmon farming a company. Personally, a Blue Marine Foundation is opposed to salmon farms in marine protected areas. They really ought not to be there. They should get out now. So some law might be needed, and some law also possibly to define the responsibilities of other extractive industries, such as trawling and pelagic vessels, pelagic purse seiners. You know, whose fish are they catching? Are they catching salmon and smolts, or, you know, and if they are, get the hell out of there, be somewhere else. Law and science, I suppose, I'd fritter my billion away on a combination of the two.
What, Charles, if you had no money, and this is, I suppose, we're saying to people who are listening to this, what can people do today, tomorrow, next week to try and make a change?
Well, I think support organizations that you are convinced have an impact. I think quite a lot of organizations don't have an impact. In terms of politics, you vote for people you believe in, if you possibly can. Whether they get in or not, it's another question. But in terms of supporting organizations, NGOs, support the ones which have an effect. That's what you can do without any money at all. But it'd be nice if you had some money, because
you could donate it.
We We exist on donations. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. NGOs, you know, we're constantly stressing how important NGOs are, especially in the current climate with regards to this word apathy we keep coming back to and how important it is. So we do stress to anybody that's listening, whether it's about salmon or whether you're just interested in what Charles has had to say, please do go and have a look at the Blue Marine Foundation, because it really is doing some extraordinarily progressive work and does need your support. Final question, Charles, just to hopefully lighten the mood somewhat. You're an angler, which is, I don't know whether you still fish. Do you still fish?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to give you a free pass here. The rivers are in pristine condition to varying degrees, certainly not as compromised as they are now, salmon rivers I'm talking about. And it's your last day on Earth, and you have a choice. You could go anywhere in the world, fish for salmon. Where would you go and who would you go with?
Well, I suppose I would go back to where it all started, really. I'd go back to the Welsh Dee, where I caught my big salmon that led me to think why the other big salmon weren't coming. And while I would probably not catch anything if I went fishing for a day on the Welsh Dee, because I've spent an awful lot of days not catching anything, it's a lovely river. And I would probably go with my great aunt, who's 96, who's seen that river in longer. For a longer time than anybody else I know, and who has caught a few salmon herself. I think one would go back home.
Charles Clover, it's been fascinating talking to you in terms of your work with the Blue Marine Foundation. Keep up the incredible work. And also, I'd highly recommend for anybody to read Rewilding the Sea, End of the Line, but especially Rewilding the Sea in the sense of it's a solutions-based book. It's not doom and gloom. It's not glass half empty. It's saying, yes, there's problems. Yes, there's issues, but we have addressed them in certain areas, in certain ways, and this is how we think it can be done. So highly recommend it for anybody listening. Do check it out. And there's some great ideas, and it opens your mind up to the possibilities, I think. To me, that's the beauty of this. It's the possibilities of what we can achieve.
We could do a lot of this. We've done some really big things, and to throw that ambition at some of the other things we need to do.
Coming up in the next episode of The Last Salmon,
we have Michael Frodin, the Swedish salmon Svengali. He's the king of salmon anglers. And I think it's about time we spend a bit of time with an angler. Don't you, Dara?
Yeah, Mikael takes us to the riverbank. He talks about, obviously, activism, talks about conservation. This is Mikael, obviously, who is so involved in that, whether it was the dams, whether it's fish farms, but by God, he gives us some great advice and tips for fishing salmon, and it's well worth the listen. You'll actually learn a lot if you're going to be going to the riverbank soon.
I had a fish in Lietza in Russia a few years back. It was, what was it, 42 pounds, full of sea lice, male, fantastic. I was by myself, and that was a pretty cool fish to catch. I've been having days when you catch at 30 in the morning and 30 at night, and next morning you think, oh, that was a fantastic day, and you go out and you catch another 30 pound.
Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to give us your feedback, rate and review. We want to open up the salmon discussion to you
and keep fighting for the salmon.